Blog Talk Radio.
About the Georgia Guidestones, and I have my lovely guest, Amy Dawson. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Good evening. I'm good, and how are you?
I'm doing good. All right, so tonight we're going to be talking about the Georgia Guidestones. So what did you find out about it? Start off.
I found out they were built in the late 70s, early 80s, and they're situated in Georgia, in Elbert County.
Yeah.
And they're a mystery. They contain instructions for rebuild, like they say the Ten Commandments of rebuilding from the apocalypse, and there's several different languages on it, all the same instructions,
yeah.
And there's astronomical alignments and all sorts of fun stuff.
So do you remember the different languages that were put onto it?
Let's see, there's English, Spanish, Swahili, Hindu, Hebrew, Arabic, Mandarin, and Russian.
Okay. But, you know, on the Gore Georgia Guidestones, you know what I find the most interesting is that it clearly states that the world should come under a new language.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I just want to see there.
So when I was reading that, you know what didn't make sense to me was, okay, if that's what they want, then why would they put it in a bazillion different languages? Why don't they just choose one?
I think that, say, something like the movie 2012 would happen. You know, there's unheard of amounts of people die. There's only a few left. You know, they chose, that in this movie, they chose certain people, and not all of them spoke English. There were scientists from, you know, Japan or Europe, anywhere in Europe, and they're choosing, and if I think about all these different languages, they're from different geographical points in the world. Like English and Spanish are mainly Western Hemisphere. Swahili's in Africa. Hindi's in India. Hebrew, a lot of people know it because it's the language of the Torah and, you know, the Hebrew faith. Arabic. A lot of people know Arabic, especially with our current like war and terrorism. If you go into the army, they'll teach you Arabic if you want to learn it. Chinese is that's another world language. Russian also, and those are incredibly large countries. So there's bound to be survivors from those countries.
So what language do you think that Georgia Guidestones is talking about? What language do they think should be the new universal language?
It says unite humanity with a living new language. So technically, it should be one that exists right now. It needs to be new language.
I mean, to me, that would just be English, because that would just make sense, wouldn't it?
No. Well, English is if you think about it, it is a fairly new language. If you think, it's made up of, like, Romance languages from Latin. It's made of Germanic languages. Even our number system's Arabic. So we do have a lot of, the melting pot of America. Our language is, an evolution of 2 centuries, 3 centuries of different people coming together. And that's how English, the modern English is. But if the person making this or designing this was, just in the 70s or 80s, English isn't new. It's been around. If you want new, maybe a form of mathematics, technically to most people would be new. Blend languages, go back to pictorial symbols. That could be something new to us. But I mean, there's a lot of, you watch science fiction of like post-apocalyptic movies, and they create new languages evolve out of people being so spread out. There's no technology to communicate, so it will change. Mad Max. All the kids' languages was all like TV sayings, or it was like really slangy words. It wasn't like the proper language that they left. So that could be a new language too. What do you think? Do you think that there should be a new one, or do you think there should be an existing one?
All right. Sorry, I just got disconnected for a second. Going back to my original question, like, what language do you think should be the new language? I think I heard a brief existing language is what you said.
Yeah, I didn't think the way it talks about it is no existing language, but like, all those apocalyptic movies, like Mad Max, the kids that survived that plane crash invented their own language based out of slang and things they heard on TV. They didn't speak Australian English. They spoke something that they knew as children, which was stuff from TV and slang words. There was no, or like things that they read, like barely, a lot of them could barely read. And they, the types of things that they would use as a language was stuff that they picked up with interacting with bikers and whatever society that was.
Yeah.
But you won't have, 90% of the population is destroyed, which this, 500 million perpetual balance population, that's less than 1% of the population. If 1% of the population survives, especially in scattered areas, you will not have a universal language.
So why do you think they built it?
Things I read on these guidestones was that the Rosicrucians built it, or the that's who funded it. Like a secret society built it. I think at that time, in let's see, it says June 1979, an unknown person under the pseudonym of R.C. Christian hired Elberton Granite Finishing Company to build the structure. Now, in 1979, the United States was in the midst of the Cold War. We were very nervous about Russia, China, hitting little red buttons and blowing the world up. Famine, gas had just skyrocketed. The 70s were famous for oil and gas shortages. Vietnam War had just ended not too long before that. There was a very big fear of a global extinction, like a global apocalypse, because of nuclear war. I can't remember when Three Mile Island was, but I want to say that was after Chernobyl. But Chernobyl hadn't happened yet. But it was very real, and maybe somebody with enough sense and money, well, I don't know about sense, but they commissioned something that they felt that, why don't we do this now? Why don't we leave this thing that can withstand a nuclear blast and can still be read just in case something happens? You know, it's why there was a rash of people building bunkers in the 1970s, you know, ever since like World War II, and that bomb got dropped on Japan. They've been building bunkers. People live in old silos saying, you know, yeah, we may have less nuclear weapons, but we still have enough to blow up the world five times over. You know, that people get nervous and they start hoarding things, building shelters, and, you know, but this is the perfect thing is, this is what would survive if that happened.
Do you think it's meant to deceive people?
What do you mean, deceive?
Do you think the Georgia Guidestones were meant to deceive people, to trick people into thinking something that's just not real?
You mean that something could happen but never would?
Yes. Basically, I'm saying that we were created to basically make people think that there will be an apocalypse. Kind of like, what's the word I want to use? Kind of like,
like a hoax?
Yeah, like a hoax.
Well, I'd have to say that you could put up a stone like this and have it be a hoax, but you haven't, one, predicted the end of the world, and two, it's not like it's just like, well, the world's going to end on, like the Mayans, the world's going to end on December 31st, 2012. And had it passed, and obviously it didn't happen, and the stones have this date on them, you know, that would have been a hoax. To have something put down that says, if in the event of, here's what you do, and they leave instructions. It's like I can't remember the name of it, but one of the first things we sent into space was this disc with all this information about the planet Earth in it, on it. It was, I think it was made of gold or platinum or some expensive metal. And it, you know, it's not a hoax. We're here. We do exist. But whenever it's found by someone, if there's, you know, people out there that find this, who's to say by the time they find it and come back, we didn't blow ourselves up already? There wouldn't be any people here. So that wouldn't be a hoax. You know, it's like, it's one of those things of, you know, it depends how you interpret it. And, like I said, at the time that these were built, the apocalypse or a nuclear war was very, very fresh on people's minds. You know, a lot of people didn't like to think about it. It was something that nobody talked about. I know my parents didn't talk about it. But it was... You read about, you learn about history, and it was very real. You know, it's like at any moment in the 80s, they were talking about, well, Russia's getting all this and that, and they're afraid they're going to push the button. Well, yeah, this wouldn't be a hoax if it, you know, if it did happen. But it could also prompt people to initiate things that would cause something like this to happen. you know, it's like it's a lot of the why people get all afraid or nervous when these mm-hmm. prediction dates come about, like 2000 or 2001.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to get back to one of the things that it said, and the number one was to maintain humanity under 500 million people in perpetual balance of nature. All right.
Mm.
This kind of creeped me out. What are they suggesting? We just kill off the best humanity? We just start killing people?
Mm.
Like,
well,
left and right, you know? That creeped me out a little bit.
Yeah, that kind of creeped me out as well. So, go on. So, you think that it, even though that no apocalypse has happened yet, you think that this would be put into practice?
Well, you know, I'm going to make a theory, and I know this is going to sound pretty, like, out there, but this is what I'm going to say. I believe that what it is a way to kind of deceive humanity into kind of believing what the new world order wants. It's kind of like fooling people into what the new world order wants, because the 10 points it makes on the stones are exactly where the world elite wants. They want all these 10 points. And it's kind of like, well, we'll throw it at people and we'll say that some savior has brought you these 10 points, but actually they're deceiving people because these 10 points are really what the new world order is. So it's kind of deceiving people. It's like, actually,
it's
they're not
preparing
good.
Them
they're
for
actually
what?
Preparing them for, well, for, I mean, okay, let's just go down the list. Number 6. Let all nations rule internally, resolving external disputes in a world court. Okay, we already have that. We have the UN, so we can check that off. That one already happened.
Well, that one was in effect
right.
before the stones were made. The UN existed since the end of World War II.
Yeah, but apparently whoever made this list already had this in mind, what he wanted. So we could check that one off. And then, okay, Christ, truth, be... I'm not really – number 9 didn't really make much sense to me because I'm not really sure what they're trying to say is prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. I'm not really sure what they're trying to make sense of that one.
That one,
I'm still
like,
kind of analyzing.
The way I read that one is like if you look at society right now, is truth prize? No. We have more sensationalism than we have truth. They have, like, what do they call the reality shows, but they're not actually reality. They're scripted and, you know, really exploited parts of, you know, life. Beauty. We don't really have beauty right now because so many people get plastic surgery to change their appearance. And our idea of beauty is only skin deep. It's not from within. Like, it kind of goes with 4, like passion, faith, tradition, all things with tempered reason. We don't have that now either.
Mm.
I mean, if you're passionate about your faith or tradition and you're too passionate, you're zealous. You're a zealot or an extremist, you know. So they're saying, you know, and then back to number 9 where it says seek love or prize love. Do we love our fellow man? You know, do we love each other? Not really, because people will kill each other for things and drugs and, you know, husbands will beat their wives and beat their kids. That's not love. You know, seek harmony with the infinite. It's like make everybody a Buddhist and call it a day. That's
yeah,
not,
well,
not, you know.
I think number three, unite humanity with the new, with a living new language. In my heart, I truly believe that what they're talking about is English, because I just cannot see on the horizon a new language coming up. So to me, I think they mean English.
Well, like, I can see where you think that. But, or it could be English, because it could very well end up being English because of where these stones are written and who reads them. They would be primarily English speakers, or, oddly enough, Spanish speakers. With, you know, living in Georgia, there's a lot of Spanish that come up from Florida.
Yeah.
So they would
you know
understand
what you know what really creeps me out about number one is I was watching some video, and there are people out there who truly believe that we need to start exterminating people to to fix our eco problems. And I was like, what sick people would think that? I mean, if these people who wrote these Georgia Guidestones truly believe that you're going to enlighten humanity by keeping a population at a limit of 500,000 people, that's insane. That means that you have to kill over... it just requires me to do math now.
Actually,
I read
it.
What's the word?
92.5% of the population. 92.54%
okay.
is the exact number.
That's pretty sick. I mean, that would be a lot of people you would have to kill.
Yeah,
and,
but I mean, there's two ways to look at it. There's putting this into motion. Like, there was an article that I actually have up on my computer that says, in 1988, Britain's Prince Philip expressed the wish that should he be reincarnated, he would want to be a deadly virus that would reduce the world's population. And then more recently, Bill Gates said, the world today has 6.8 billion people, that's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by 10 to 15%. Saying that if we do a good job at not giving people vaccines, at letting stuff like, the plague come back, or like a super flu from 1918, or, you know, these deadly bugs that just, like, wiped out entire areas just, like, overnight. Or there's a new one that I've heard about. They had a couple of cases in Alabama, I want to say it was. Or was it France? I want to say both. It's, like, this new flu, and they said it's very similar to the bird flu, but not exactly the same, and it's incredibly deadly. But they haven't had enough cases of it to warrant even barely an article that's like two paragraphs long about it. So that's something, like, they're engineering something like this to happen, where there's a disease created that does wipe out this 92% of the population, or something freakish like an asteroid happens, or a nuclear accident, not us blowing each other up, but some kind of horrific accident that happens to reduce the population. It's bound to happen one way or the other. So, you know, and I mean, it is scary that people do think this way, but it's, you know, it's scary that, I mean, I run into people who believe a lot of different things that terribly frighten me. You know, that we have, you know, people going around believing things like this. And it's like, do they really want to exterminate, you know, most of the planet? Who would they pick to live? Who would they get rid of? Would they make an account for children or families?
Yeah.
You know, would they tear families apart?
Yeah, well, when I read this, I think of a lot. I think whoever wrote this, you know, You know, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is I think of, like, the early 1900s, the late 1800s, and I think of the whole thing with eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because number two was improving fitness and diversity,
mm-hmm.
you know, guide reproduction wisely. Well, that right there with maintaining humanity under 500,000, what that tells me is that whatever these people are asking for, to me, it sounds a lot like they basically, I know this is going to sound sick, but to me, it sounds like they're going to, like, pick and choose or inflict some kind of, well, only this race can have this amount of babies, or that it'll be kind of some kind of lottery system, or it's just freaky.
Like what the Nazis did.
And you can pick and choose the people in your society.
There's eugenics. There's limiting reproduction, which China did for a long time, and most of the world
mm-hmm.
kind of went, oh. Well, that's kind of, that's a little harsh, but if you look at their population and how much food they have sustained themselves, they weren't, and you didn't look at it, most people didn't know this, but they were killing children that were born, usually girls, because they were allowed one child apiece, and it was better to have a male, it was more honorable to have a male than a female.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of children died in China. That's coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's come to light in the past, like, decade or so. But that did happen for a very long time. Not so much now, though. So there's, you know, there's the discouragement of having more than one child, and then there's the selective breeding, which you could theoretically, if you were to take scientists of today against, like, the Nazi scientists, were going for visual. And external, they wanted tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, strapping kids, you know, 6 feet plus tall, to rule the world for them. Their leaders
mm-hmm.
weren't like that. You know, Hitler was under 5'10", brown-haired, brown-eyed. He wasn't, you know, that ideal. But they wanted to create this master race by breeding,
mm-hmm.
you know, like-looking people, but if you breed too closely, like if you breed, let's say you breed a bunch of these blonde children together, who's to say that they don't have an underlying genetic flaw that would make their children useless? You know, they'd
mm-hmm.
be either mentally retarded or they'd have some kind of, like, you know, genetic disease that the Nazis couldn't detect back then. You know, that's just, you know, they were breeding on a superficial level, and it was horrific. They were killing
mm-hmm.
millions of people that didn't fit their physical or mental blueprint. They didn't even look at their DNA. They didn't even look at what diseases ran in their family. They just were out looking on the outside. Now, today, we have mapped the human genome. We know a lot of genetic diseases and their markers, we'd be killing that many of the world's population off just by looking at, let's say, person A is susceptible for diabetes, will probably have a stroke before they're 60, will need glasses before they're 20, you know, and they can tell all this before that. You know, before the child's even born. Or this person is going to get osteoporosis no matter how much calcium they take. Or this person's going to get cancer. Or this person's going to have a bad heart. You know, they can exterminate that life before it even starts if they find all these red flags, quote unquote. Or they have the dormant gene for cystic fibrosis, but if they pair up with another person with that gene, their kids are going to have it. Or, you know, there's so much So if you try to eliminate all these people with quote-unquote genetic markers that raise to them red flags, you will get rid of 90-something percent of the population.
Yeah.
Because not
Sorry,
even
Amy.
Wealthy millionaires like Bill Gates have perfect DNA. There's absolutely no way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know this is going to sound creepy, but this is what I believe. What if some of these top families, some of the top CEOs in the world, all were able to be the controlling class? Almost, I know I talked to you about this before, the whole technocracy. You know,
yeah.
Kind of like all the engineers, all the CEOs, all the scientists all come together and they form the governing body of the world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they can kind of pick and choose how they want to structure the world and design the world in a scientific way. Now, that's pretty creepy, but... It's already kind of happening in a way, not directly like in a governing way. I mean, they're not in Washington or they're not governing, but in a kind of like a nonprofit sort of way is they're kind of getting whatever kind of fund they have, but they could technically use that for a political purpose and kind of do whatever they want with it and kind of use their money to kind of basically use it for the political agenda for whatever they have. That's pretty creepy. You know,
yeah,
I mean, you have...
I mean, it happens with a lot of businesses now that, you know, they call it big oil, OPEC, stuff like that. You know, they're like, oh, well, don't go to clean energy because we like oil. We want to keep spending money on it. You know, don't make an electric car because, you know, we won't make any money, but we'll fund you to get into office if you vote in our favor, you know. But, or... hey, I'll make your kid the captain of the football team. Oh, wait, you don't even have kids yet, but he'll still be captain of the football team. How about that? Why don't you, I'll vote for you, and you vote on my agenda for such and such research down the road, and I'll make your kid a star. You know, they can, that's like something like what you're talking about. It's like they'll use the, legacy guilt trip.
Yeah. I think the problem really is that ever since the Industrial Revolution has came, I don't think people didn't know where technology innovation was going to lead them. I mean, now we have Facebook, we have things, but all these things kind of dehumanize people. You know, I mean, when you go back to like the Renaissance, you know, you have artwork, you have literature, you have things that, you know, really, you know, show, you know, what it means to be human and art and literature, you know, feelings and emotions. But all this technology really, really doesn't really show any emotion. It just shows logic. It shows reason. It just shows things that really don't show the humanistic nature of people. And that's really sad. And, you know what's, you know, as a people of the world, I mean, it's really interesting to see where civilization is going because I mean, either you could follow down this path since the Industrial Revolution. I truly believe that technology serves a purpose, but I just believe that it is blinding us from our humanistic nature. I mean, because there is a sense that there is this creativity. You know, I mean, what's sad is that when you take a math class or you take a science class, but you take the literature and the history and art out of it. I mean, you don't really get like a kind of
you don't
like
get the hows and the whys. You just get the what.
Yeah, I mean, you don't. Everything kind of goes together, and, you know, I mean, I think that math and science, technology all serve a purpose in this world. You know, I mean, since the Industrial Revolution, I mean, we've seen countless changes. I mean, World War One, to me, when you look at World War One, I really truly think that that was kind of the turning point. That, to me, World War One was kind of like the...
That broke
kind of like the
world, because the...
Yeah. I mean, that really showed the dark side of
the
Industrial Revolution.
There was a Great World Fair, like, not long afterwards, and they showed a lot of new technology, like electricity and, you know, these different guns. But they used them in a very defined sense. And suddenly World War One happened, and hundreds of thousands of people died because of the same technology. And people were horrified. I mean, they had not seen death like this. But, like, they remembered the American Civil War. Oh, yeah, that was bad. It was bad. But this was the entire Western world involved in one war, and they were losing hundreds of thousands of lives. And they couldn't...
Mm-hmm.
People couldn't grasp this kind of carnage. You know, they couldn't... And, you know, the newspapers, photographs, film was coming out, you know. They were taking pictures of this stuff and sending it off to newspapers.
Well, I mean, the problem with science, and this is, you know, my personal problem with it, is that when you try to take the scientific method and apply it to, like, the paranormal, to, like, studying ghosts, I mean, you can't really apply it to that. You can't just apply it to ghosts. I mean, you just can't ask a ghost to come, oh, knock the wall, okay, one. Knock the wall again, too. You can't have repetition. It's not like science. You can't have tangible evidence. It just doesn't work. So, I mean, the problem really is that, okay, well, where do we go now? Where does science go?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after we solve all the physical questions of the universe, I mean, don't we have metaphysical questions to answer, too? Yeah. Do I think that will ever happen? Probably not, because I think that people do not want science and religion to cross paths.
Well, there's a difference between, like, when I think of science and religion, I think of, like, science and morality. It's like when they came out with stem cell research. And they were talking about, well, this is all the great things it can do, and this and that and the other. And they're like, okay, so what do you need to do that? Umbilical cord, miscarried or aborted fetuses. Wait a minute, that's against our religious code. No, you can't do that. And across the world, boom, bills were shot down. No stem cell research because it's bad, you know? And they didn't take into account of, well, you can theoretically, if, you know, harvest the stem cells and not kill the fetus, or if the fetus is miscarried, you can harvest it. And that person, when they grow up, will have their stem cells stored for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you know, all this stuff. But when it first came out, people were horrified at the prospect of it. Until about 5 years went by, and people saying, no, you don't have to kill anybody. Nobody has to die. This can happen without all this, you know, carnage. It's safe. But there is also you can go both ways. You can use it for bad, which would be, you know, the excuse to destroy lives. Or you could find a way to do it without killing everyone. It's like cloning. People are, no. Cloning human beings is out of the question. No, absolutely not. But they said, okay, well, what if we just clone your ear? So if in case, or we take a cell from your ear that says what it's going to do, you lose your ear, we can make you a new one. Soldiers come home from Iraq. They can grow them new limbs.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's technically cloning, but it's not, you know, you don't have a twin sitting next to you. You just have a spare leg hanging around. You know, I mean, I don't think, I don't think cloning an entire person is correct. I mean, you can grow an ear on the back of a mouse, you know, for somebody. I mean, it's, I've seen, you know, I've read articles on it. It's happened.
Well,
But it's like you can either make an army of clones or you can help people who are injured. So there's that good and then there's the bad. But I agree with science and religion. People don't want it to mix. People don't want to say, well, you know, my religion is okay with this, and then suddenly, you know, they're using science to test their faith. That won't sit well with a lot of people. Like, you know, like you said, you can't really make a ghost do something it doesn't want to do. You can't repeat an experiment. Well, let's repeat a miracle. Let's see if we can, you know, have a plane, you know, be saved from dropping out of the sky under the same circumstances twice. Can we repeat that miracle? Or, you know, that will happen. Or can we have people pray systematically to see if it affects outcomes of things, you know?
I want to talk about that a little bit later, but I want to get back to something I said that's kind of off paranormal a little bit, but you know what I mean, obviously is really sad is that teachers, you know, it's the fact that people, I mean, education is really sad, and it's just the point that, you know, I mean, you try to find things to invest in. I mean, education to me should be the number one thing, you know, in the world because I mean, the things that we're talking about, you know, creating a better world, you know, that starts in, you know, in schools when people learn, you know, are educated and they learn about the past and they learn about science and they learn about all these things that they could use for a career that makes the world better. And I think that if we put more time and effort and money into education, I mean, who knows where, you know, how we rebalance the budget to, you know, to make education better in the country. But that's really where the piece comes from. I mean, let's look at Elizabethan England, okay? You know, Queen Elizabeth did something very great, and I think that her policies were some of probably the best. She put a lot of money into the arts programs in the English schools during her time as queen. You know, that was probably one of the best things because there's just the amount of...
Wasn't she responsible for founding, like, Cambridge University and Oxford?
Yeah.
Or am I getting later?
Yeah.
But
she was, you know, I think it's funny because everybody thought she was going to be this horrible queen and that she was just going to fail. And that, you know, everybody was like, oh, I guess we were wrong. She was pretty good. Everybody was nervous. Everybody was like, oh, well, darn, I mean, she's going to fail.
Well, I hope she wouldn't be like her father because he was kind of a little crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. But, no, she was probably one of the best monarchs of England ever time. But her overwhelming, you know, reforms in education and just promoting the arts in schools, you know, was probably one of the best things she's done. You know, it really was great. I mean, but we don't really have those programs here, and I wish we did. I wish we invested more time and energy into those after school programs and things of that nature.
There are places that are starting to do.
Yeah.
Are starting to notice how passionless people who are now entering high school, who are now soon entering college, they are glued to technology. They cannot function without it. They have no imagination.
Yeah, but
and they have no grasp on the world as a whole in terms of their history.
I want to make one more comment on that. And, I know everybody's not going to believe me, but I truly believe that what's going to happen in America is that what's going to happen is that you are going to have class of workers that will only have to work minimum wage jobs, okay? You're going to have this, I don't want to say poverty class, but I know this is going to sound really bad, but I truly believe that there will be a surf state class. There will be a class in America that will be so poor that they won't even be able to afford their own shelter, their own food. I know what is happening right now. But what's happening is that because our education system isn't preparing students, because we have this family structure, you know, problem all over the world, I mean, besides America. But in America, what's going to happen is that kids will just say, oh, I just don't want to go to school. I'll just go work in the factory. So what happens now? Well, you can't afford a house. You can't afford to buy food. So we'll just have a new surf class in America. We'll just have a class of citizens in America who are working poor. They are economic slaves. They are slaves to the government. I mean, that's who they'll be working for.
That's already happened. But, I mean, it's
yeah,
not
it is
as
happening. We have it in Florida. Yeah.
It's not as evident as,
yeah,
say, like,
I mean,
India has a caste system.
Yeah.
And which is disappearing, I might add. But it will pretty much, if you're born in the slums, you stay there.
Yeah.
You don't get out. If
yeah.
you're born
well,
rich, you stay there. You can squander away your money, and somehow your children will be rich too. It's really strange in that country. I know a couple of people from there, and they say that, you know, it's just for some reason, no matter how one lives their life, they always maintain that standard of living. And it's like,
I know this is turning.
You know, you think about like Bill Gates, right? And I bet he spends a lot of money. I mean, but I would think that if you take his, like, say, 100% of his income, right? And you take somebody who works at McDonald's who makes minimum wage, 100% of their income, right? He spends a less percentage of his income on things he does not need. He probably only buys clothes, healthy food, books for education for his kids, pays for a quality education for his kids, while... the person who works at McDonald's eats fast food, pays for cable, sits in their house all day, doesn't exercise, and buys stuff to entertain themselves, like video games and, you know, technology. And they don't spend time outdoors. They don't read books. They don't go to museums. They don't do any of that. So they spend a larger percentage of their income on useless things. Things they don't need.
Yeah, but I don't mean, whatever Bill Gates spends his money on, you know, is his own personal
thing. Yeah, I'm just using him as an example because everybody knows
I mean, but, I mean, the point that I was trying to make, I know this kind of got way off paranormal, but the point that I was trying to make was that, you know, I don't mean any offense to anybody that, you know, uses federal programs. I think that's fine. You know, I have no problem with that, but well, no, but what I kind of seen is that, okay, so what's going to happen is that, this is what I believe, is that over time you will have this class of people that will just have bare bones education, like a GED, just bare bones, and they will just be working poor. They'll just basically have subsidized housing, pay for the government, food, pay for the government. They just will be some economic slaves in certain states. You know, like here in Florida, we have sugar, okay? People, we have people come over, they cut the sugar from Mexico, okay? So, I mean, they get on, they don't even get paid minimum wage. They don't even ask me. I don't even know how
migrant
they do
workers.
It. But,
they're migrant workers.
Yeah, migrant workers. But I don't even know how they don't get caught, but so, all right, so they get paid. All right, now it's payday. Okay, where am I going to live? I need some food. Oh, if you give me your paycheck, I'll give you some shelter and some food. Okay, so then what happens is that you're a slave. You are a slave. You are a slave to this guy who cut his sugar cane. I mean, that's just horrible. You know, I was reading an article. You know that 19% of our labor force is foreign-born. But how much of it is undocumented? I mean, that's just crazy.
Oh, great. No.
Yeah.
But, anyway, that number
that's
eight,
really
balance personal rights with social duties. In terms of your economic, in terms of your economic slavery, that wouldn't happen. What happens, like, okay, if there is an apocalypse, if it is one of those accidental population wipeouts, there will be no government.
Yeah.
These people will have no one to depend on for their basic needs, like food. There will be no food stamps. They will not know how to grow their own food. They will not know how to hunt. They will not know how to, find a existence without, you know, what's handed to them. It's like, yes, you're handing this man that you work for your paycheck, which he pays you. You're giving it back to him to pick more sugar cane. And, you know, that's a debt circle right there. A lot of America's in that, but instead of that, we have credit cards. The middle class has credit cards where, oh, we'll buy this and you need this credit at a certain number to buy a home. Well, what if you don't have that number? Can you buy a home? Yeah, if you pay cash for it, if you can manage to save up enough money to not have a mortgage, which, fortunately, a lot of people are now doing. You know, they're buying homes at these quote-unquote foreclosed prices, which is technically all they're worth. They're not going to have a mortgage, so they will owe these banks nothing. And it's getting to the point where there are people with the knowledge saying, I'm going to buy this house because it's going to be mine. It's not going to be owned by that bank. I'm not going to have to pay them interest. I'm not going to be in the debt cycle. But then there's other people who don't know anything but that. Their parents were in it. All their cousins and brothers and sisters are in this debt circle. And you're right. If we are not educating our children with how to get out of these circles or how to survive, you know, using their wit, their mind, and their ingenuity, rather than slave labor picking sugarcane or whatever it is, you know, stitching clothing. If we don't teach them to, you know, progress, there will be, you're right, there will be a poorer class of people than we're used to even now, to where they can't get out of it. Do you have anything to add to that? Maybe we are having technical difficulties again. But at the same time, it could be like that, the movie, I don't know, I'm having trouble remembering the name of it now, but they lived on time, and on their wrist would be how much time they had. They didn't live off years. They lived until, they matured until they were about 25. I think it's actually called time. But they lived until they were 25, and then their clock started to tick. And the really, really rich had hundreds and hundreds of years, like thousands of years, built up on these little clocks. They could live forever. Now, these poor would have hours and minutes of credit until their next payday. And literally, they were working to live. I mean, everything cost time instead of money. They had, you know, to buy food, you had to pay 15 cents or 15 minutes for a cup of coffee or something ridiculous like that. And, you know, watching that movie, you think, oh, well, this would never happen, you know, and it's sort of like that, you know, in a way it's like that. we work so hard to make money, to live, to eat, to pay for the things that we want. How much of our life are we burning to do that? How many people are working such stressful jobs that, you know, they kill themselves working? You know, they don't make it to retirement. They don't see their kids go to college because they couldn't survive long enough. Or some of, you know, people have mental problems. They're too stressed out. Their minds break and they go into institutions. But I think generally this Georgia Guidestone, it can be looked at both a sinister light and a potentially positive light. They don't, they've been graffitied with Down with the New World Order and, you know, that they're satanic or, you know, as Chris mentioned, they say that they were built by the Rosicrucians who were, Google them, they're an interesting read. But, you know, if they're for an accidental apocalypse asteroid, you know, some nuclear plant blows up, we have the ice caps melting, anything accidental, then they might be useful to rebuild humanity. But if they're a guide to what we need to do to humanity, then that's a completely dark purpose for those stones. Well, I'd like to thank Chris for having me on again, and since he's still having technical difficulties, so I will sign off for the night. Thank you, everyone who has listened, and join us next time. Good night.